it's really important, I think, that we think about what's happening to children in church. All of you, how many of you were a child in church once upon a time? Does that include everyone? Well, you know, some people didn't have church when they were kids. They came to it as adults. But I think it's real. How many of you remember what you felt like in church when you were the age of this child? Anybody? A little bit young. It's not a conscious memory, but do you think it's in there? Do you think how you feel about church has something to do with what happened to you in church when you were that age, if you got to eat animal crackers? Or I remember very distinctly my early years in church, probably not that young, but I remember that my father was in the pulpit and my mother was in the choir, which meant that I was on my own, but I was not someone that you would leave on her own in church. And so some dear, dear unmarried ladies that were the self-appointed altar guild and were my self-appointed fairy godmothers who either made or bought almost my entire wardrobe. Very loving people, and they kept me in church, but they bribed me. If I behaved, I got either a piece of a Hershey bar or some pecans that were wrapped up in wax paper in Aunt Minnie's purse. I don't recall that I didn't ever get them, so I have a feeling that the bribe was not very strong, because I know that I was not, you know, your best behaved little kid in church. I remember very strongly my father's hand on my shoulder right here and saying, "You can't run down the aisles. You have to set an example for the other children. You're the minister's child." Heavy message for a little kid. I think I was about 7 with that memory. I also remember breaking my beads that my father had brought me from Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. When he went to a pastor's conference, he brought me a string of pearls. And I remember pulling on them, and they broke, and this church was at a slope, and they all rolled down to the front. So, you know, the kinds of memories that you have from your early years in church that stick out are one thing. But there are lots of memories down there that shape how we feel about worship that started when we were very young. And I guess I'm here to advocate for children that we need to be creating a base of good feelings about that. So let's look for a little bit about who we were as children and who the children are that we're working with. It's hard to remember that there is that little child, you know, and last night when we sang little boy, and little girl, that's still in there, who we were when we were this age, and 2 and 7 and 15, even though we're adults now. I think it's interesting to think about the fact that we are still changing, and we always have changed. We used to be like that, and now look at us, you know, and sometimes you wish you could start over again and redo it properly, but there's always time to change our lifestyle, as the JAMP guards are telling us, and bring it more into maybe what the Lord had in mind for us. But we're always changing, and the label for this change is growth. Physical growth, intellectual growth, hopefully social and emotional growth. It doesn't necessarily come with a package that we will grow socially and emotionally. And finally, spiritual growth, which is based on how we're growing in these other areas. And I think that's a very important thing to remember with children. If we do a good job with children in the other areas, we're making a solid base for spiritual growth and for faith development. I was hoping to do a workshop on faith development too, but I have to leave tomorrow and I didn't get that many opportunities, so you won't hear that one another year. But even when physical growth in the sense of growing so big and then maintaining your adult height stops, the growth in the other areas should continue, and it's one thing that we should work on, isn't it? That we continue to grow spiritually and emotionally and socially and continue to mature. And under optimum conditions, we'll do that. Now, all of these areas of growth are connected. You can't say, well, now I'm going to work on my child's social development, because every way that your child is growing, he or she is growing at the same time, and they're all interdependent. And the spiritual development, I think, is of all of them the most dependent on what happens in the others. But one of the things that I think as adults we tend to overlook or forget about or maybe not even know about is that all of these areas of growth, intellectual growth, social and emotional growth, and spiritual growth, are dependent upon physical growth. The brain starts growing this way and it grows this direction. And children can't do certain things socially. They can't behave certain ways emotionally. They can't learn certain things intellectually until the physical growth has gotten to a certain level. So that's all based on physical growth. And that's very important to remember, especially if you're looking at somebody who physically is bigger than other people his same age, you know, or smaller than. You don't expect as much of a smaller child, even though the maturation of the brain probably is advanced compared to the physical size. So during the early years of life, learning and growth is going on much more rapidly than at any other time in life. We really slow down, just as physical growth. If you remember your child as an infant, the first year of life they grew very rapidly, didn't they? And I remember my pediatrician saying, toward the end of the first year, now be prepared for this this child to cut back on his caloric intake because he simply doesn't need as much food now in the second year as he did in the first year because he's not growing as fast. So this is also true of intellectual growth. Kathy said the other day, a different stage than I had read, what I have learned is that half of what we ever learn, we learn before age 6. And she said some authorities say 5 and some even say 3. Now, I think that's scary. I think that's really scary because our society does not do much to help us with children's learning in those first 3 years. And yet those are the crucial years for learning. Now think about what's going on in your church. What is your congregation doing to enable the members of that congregation from birth to 3 to do the kind of learning that is going to make a good bedrock foundation for faith development? What are they doing for the birth to 3 group? Anything? Okay, both Fortress and Augsburg have developed little packets like that now. They're a little bit different. One, I think Augsburg's has the stuff goes out more frequently or something.
Every 3 months.
Mm-hmm. From the Augsburg series.
From the Fortress, too.
Okay, I'm not as familiar with Fortresses. A friend of mine wrote the Augsburg stuff, but I don't know Fortress very well. But, you know, think of all that parents need to know in those first 3 months. And where do they get that training? And I really would like to advocate that, we begin to do some parent education or have support groups for parents. It's tough being a parent. It's much tougher being a parent now than it was when I parented my kids, and probably than when you parented your kids. When my mother parented me, it was much easier. It was easier, as we were talking last night, about an earlier age when probably more people lived in smaller communities where the values were at least the spoken values. I mean, I'm sure there was crime and prostitution and drugs and all these things that we're battling now, but they weren't on the surface acceptable like they are now. So that you could expect that teachers would not be giving your children the kind of input that you were against. It was a much more homogeneous society, I think, than we have now. But this is important, I think, for us to remember as church members, because as church members, we all have power to shape the program in the church. Even though we have hired staff to do that, it's we putting the pressure on those people that gets the program to happen or not to happen. And I don't think much is happening for parents in the first 3 years. One of the things that's very crucial for us to remember about those first 3 years is that our thinking abilities are qualitatively different than they will be later in life. This child does not think the same way that you and I do. He doesn't think the same way that the four-year-olds that are out here playing in the sand this morning. I came out of my chalet this morning, and there were two darling little kids right at the foot of my steps, and one said, "We found a baby bunny." And, you know, I looked to see where this rabbit family was, and he opened his hand and showed me this little tiny rock, and he said, "See, here's the eye, and here's the mouth." He was imagining this rock to be a baby bunny. It's wonderful. But this child can't do that yet. If he looks at a rock, it's a rock, and he doesn't even know it's a rock. He can't even put a label onto that yet. That's the next stage of development. But all children are learning, and they're learning all the time. And I think that's very important for us to think about the children that are in the congregation, in the worship service with us. They are learning all the time. And they will either learn by what we have planned, or they will learn by default. And I think that's what's happening more than plan during the worship service. And this workshop is about thinking about planning, without which people who are now young members of the congregation may learn by default that worship is not a worthwhile way to spend their Sunday morning, and that it doesn't meet a felt spiritual need in their lives. And I think a lot of people have learned that we're raised in church and they don't come back when they get to the age where they can make that choice for themselves. So how do children get these ideas about worship? The label that psychologists put on that is perception, perceiving, bringing, all our lives we do this, but people this age are dependent on bringing information in through the senses. Is it a he? It's a she. Oh, dear. That's how we judge them. See, I'm judging by perception. If it has hair, it's a she. If it has no hair, it's a he. All right, she takes in information through her senses and through her muscles. And so this stage of life has been labeled the sensory motor stage because it's sensors, the senses, and we call muscle movement the motor stuff. So, you know, all children take it. We never stopped doing that until the senses died down. My mother's 93, and this is one of her problems in life now, is that her senses aren't functioning at a very high level anymore. So her sensory input is very dull. She can't see things very well. She doesn't hear as well as she did. Things don't taste like they once do. She doesn't smell things that the way she used to. This child is dependent on senses. We use senses a lot too, but we also have other ways of taking information, of thinking about information that aren't available to this youngster yet because his brain hasn't, or her brain hasn't grown to that point. Some reactions that children have made about the service is, and I'm quoting children now, "It stinks." Another one is, "We eat a lot." Another one was, "The organ sounds like Dracula." Another one is, "My eyes are filled with colors." Now see, all of those are physical perceptions taken in by the senses. But there are other there's other input coming along as the children get older, and that's, and even with this youngster too, that are affective perceptions, which means on a feeling level. Social and emotional perceptions are also available to children at all times and to all of us. Feelings of acceptance and non-acceptance. Whether my behavior is accepted, whether my clothing is accepted, my voice, you know, do we accept this little voice interrupting now, or are we going to give the mother dirty looks now, you know? And you may have had that experience. I have a little portable computer, and I take it to conferences and take notes because I can type about 3 times faster than I can write, and also if I look back at those notes a year later, I can read them, which I can't when I'm trying to write down everything the speaker says and not getting it. And I've had a really not very nice experience at a conference in New Orleans last year. Usually when the keys click, so they make a little noise, and usually when I'm doing this, people nearby will look and they see what I'm doing and they're fascinated, you know, and their expression says, "Oh, isn't that interesting? Look, somebody's, you know, what's she doing? Is that a typewriter? What is that?" There's curiosity, there's interest. But this one, I sat about 2 empty seats away from a woman, and she looked at me, and then she sort of moved closer to the speaker, and then she moved even closer, and the next thing she was going like this. And finally, she turned to me and said, "You know, that's very distracting." And you know, her perception of it was different. Now, what were my feelings about this? You know, I was embarrassed that I was laying something on her that she didn't like. I mean, she had a right to hear that lecture just as much as I had a right to take notes. So now the balance, you know, did I have a right to take notes that kept her from hearing the speaker, and you know, in a way that did that? So you know, I felt embarrassed about it. I felt like I didn't belong, and I felt a need to get up and move, which I did. I moved to the back of the room, and then I kind of looked around and hoped that I wouldn't disturb somebody else. And after that, I made it a real point to sit, try to get the last seat on the end of the last row, so that, you know, more people would be ahead of me and I wouldn't be as disruptive to other people. So children feel like that a lot too, from the way we accept them or don't accept them in worship. And I guess the question here is, do little people belong in the worship service, or is it like going to a concert? I get very, very upset when I buy an expensive symphony ticket and go down to hear the Minnesota Orchestra, and somebody behind me decides to carry on a conversation and whispers through the number. And I think, why did they buy this expensive ticket to come here if what they really want is to visit? Why didn't they go to a restaurant where visiting is the norm? You know, at a concert, visiting is not the norm. You sit and you listen and you talk in between the numbers or at the intermission. And I don't hesitate to turn around and give those people a look, or, you know, when the thing stops, to ask them if they would please mind either visiting in the lobby or, you know, waiting till between numbers, because I feel like I have a right, having bought my ticket, to hear this music. That's what we all came for, didn't we? But does that same feeling about performance prevail in the worship service, I guess, is the big question. And I think in a lot of congregations it does. And everybody's supposed to do the same thing at the same time. And when the pastor talks, we're all supposed to shut up. It's his turn. But, you know, toddlers don't understand that. People this age don't understand that. You see, they can't, well, we'll get into that in a second. We're talking about perception, and the second stage then is assimilation. This new knowledge is now added to the knowledge that I've already got stored in my head. And I now accommodate this new knowledge to change the knowledge that I already have. And this is the way growth is, for intellectual growth comes about. For a young child, it might work a little like this. I come into church, I sit down between my parents. There's nothing to do. So I look around to find something to do, because, you know, little people don't tolerate boredom. They find something to do if there's nothing to do. We're willing to just sit and wait, but they're not. So I look around and I listen. People are talking. I can't understand what they're saying, and I don't find it interesting, so I don't get in with that. Oh, I see a book. Now, I like books, so I reach for the book. Oh, it's too heavy. I can't hold it. It drops with a loud bang. I notice someone's head turn toward me quickly. The face frowns at me. My father looks away. What's wrong? Is he embarrassed? My mother catches her breath as though something has gone wrong. She picks up the book. She straightens the bent pages. She frowns and she goes, did I do something wrong? Well, the book doesn't have any pictures in it anyway, so it's not very interesting. But I feel uncomfortable. I don't like to feel uncomfortable, so I want to get away from this feeling of discomfort. So I stop looking at the book and at my mother. I turn around, look behind me. It's all wood back there, dull and brown. That isn't very interesting either. Maybe if I kneel. Oh, this is better. Wow, there are people back here. One of them smiles at me. I smile back. Someone else clears her throat. My mother turns me around quickly. Why is she so rough? She isn't usually rough like that. Why can't you sit still? She whispers. Why is she whispering? She doesn't usually whisper at me. I don't know why I can't sit still. I don't know why I should sit still. Now we stand up. Hooray, I like that. Now all I can see is people's backs. I'll see if that lady will smile at me again. No, I better not do that. My mother may turn me around again roughly, and I didn't like that. And on through the service. Now, what is this child learning through these experiences? Did she learn some good things and some things that weren't so helpful? What did she learn that was helpful? People can smile, yes. What did she learn that maybe wasn't so helpful? Yeah. Not for little kids, is it? Even mother changes in this situation from the mother I know at home. Why does she do that? You know, what's happening to the mother in this scenario?
She feels pressured.
She feels pressured, yeah. What's made her feel pressured?
Expectation of how children are
acting. And did she get some input from the people around her on that?
Yes.
Someone cleared her throat, didn't she? Someone else frowned. And the mother takes all that in, and then the mother reacts and changes her behavior toward the child. Have you ever witnessed this? Have you ever had it happen to you? Or is that part of the dim, dull memory? I don't remember that in specific instances, but it feels like stuff that's buried in my memory. You know, the only one I can specifically remember is the one I described to you of my father's hand on my shoulder saying, you have to set an example to the other children. Now that's a heavy load, but I think we lay this on kids, that there are expectations for children's behavior. Well, what I want to talk about next is those expectations, and on what are they based? Are they based on the way God made children? Or are they based on who knows what? I don't know where we've gotten them.
I think they're based on adult attention span and ability.
Yeah, but why do we lay that on children, I think, is, you know, we do. We base our expectations for children on what we're able to do and what our needs are, rather than who they are. Well, and I think it's right that children shouldn't run in God's house. What I take issue with my dad was that I should be setting an example. You know, if it's wrong to run in God's house, then it's wrong for all children, not just the preacher's kid. And everyone should have that. And I shouldn't have had, you know, such a heavy burden that I had to be Miss Perfect because other children were watching me. You know, behavior shouldn't be based on what other people are thinking of you. But, you know, that was laid on my father. You know, he would be criticized if his children weren't doing what the expectations were for the other children. So I can't blame him either. And I think we've come a long way in that area that was not available to us in the day that when I was a child. Yeah, that was 50 years ago. That's 50 years, there have been an awful lot of changes in human behavior and our expectations, even the way we dress. I've learned, I think, a lot about that coming here. You know, to take communion from somebody who's wearing these plastic thongs and have their dirty toenails sticking out. You know, how are you going to have clean toenails by the time you walk from the shower to here? You're going to have dirty toenails. And I remember the first time, we used to kneel. There used to be cushions around here that we'd kneel on, and you know, you'd be staring at these dirty feet walking by in these little sandals. And that was a whole new one to me because, you know, my father always polished his shoes on Saturday nights before he gave communion. And Herb did too. So that's, you know, that's, it was a whole merging of the secular and the sacred was what came about from spending time here. Well, at first, during childhood, as I've stated, our thinking is qualitatively different from adults. But we all go through the same sequence of taking in information and accommodating it to the information that we already have and assimilating it and then reaching a state of equilibrium so that we feel natural again now. But let's look at the children. Now, the youngest children, like our friend over here, at the pre-language stage, how old is this child?
Just one.
Just one. So she probably has a word or two that she says?
One.
Mama, or she knows we're talking about her. Look at that. She came to attention there. So usually people, girls at age one have max five words, you know, mommy, daddy, maybe cookie or bye-bye or something like that. But they're really pretty pre-language oriented from there on down. And at that point, as I said before, all learning comes through the senses and the muscles. What are their needs? They have a strong need for touch, very strong, and a strong need for cuddling. See, look what she's doing right now, see? Just crawling all over Mom. And if you put her down, she'll come back really quickly, won't she? Because the need for touch is very strong. We never outgrow that need for touch, much as our Scandinavian and North German heritage has tried to teach us that. We need touch. I notice my mother needs touch a great deal more than she used to. Anybody that comes in her room to tend to her now, she will say, come over here, I'll give you a kiss. But it's because she needs that touch. And we need to fondle her a lot when we're visiting her and stroke her and so on again. People this age need to move when they're awake. I mean, that child cannot sit still now and listen to me, no matter how much our expectations are that she should sit still. I mean, think about a newborn baby. What are they doing when they're awake? What's happening to their arms? They're just constantly moving, aren't they? Arms and legs are just going, 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 going. Why is that? Doesn't that annoy you to watch a child that age? I mean, isn't it stressful, this movement? Sit still, will you? Calm down. Why do they do that? The muscles need to exercise in order to grow, don't they? And because they sleep so many hours, they've got to move all the time they're awake. Okay, they also need to investigate. Is some investigating going on there? You should really have this child right here as we're using this for an example. isn't she investigating those animal crackers, and that's why the box fell, and she's looking over your shoulder and everything? The need to know. I mean, imagine if you're going to learn half of what you ever learn by the time you start school. You really have to get busy with that, especially when you sleep 12 hours a day. That only leaves you half the day to investigate stuff. A lot of the investigating goes on with the mouth. Now, that's not so easy in church, is it? Because we don't want this slobber on the hymnals and the communion cards and the pencils and the pews. I mean, have you ever seen a baby pull itself forward on the pew and start to chew on the back of the pew? That's because the most dominant sensory modality at that age is still the mouth. Now, it begins to fade at about her age, so that it cuts back. But even 2 and 3 year olds, twos are really still very bad with it. But even in nursery school, the 3 year olds, you have to watch them like a hawk, or they'll put the paste in their mouths and give them any food. You're spreading your own peanut butter sandwich, and the next thing you know, the knife is in the mouth. I wonder if that's why they've taken peanut butter off every table up in the hotel, because we used to have peanut butter on every table, and you really didn't know if you wanted to eat it. I mean, it stayed there, and they just kept refilling these jars, and I saw many a child put the knife in, spread the bread in there, lick it. One of the most important things for us to consider with babies this age in church is that this is a stage of life when we either develop trust or don't develop trust. And we develop trust by the way our basic needs are cared for and are gratified, and the quickness with that. I mean, if a baby always has to cry and cry to be nursed, that child will learn not to trust, because, think of it, they're 100%... 100% dependent on us at that point in time. So if we don't gratify those needs, where can the baby go for that? If you don't cuddle that baby, where can that baby go to get that? I mean, it can't go. It's dependent, 100%. So if it learns that my needs aren't gratified instantly, then this is a tough world to live in, and I can't trust this world. Now, what has that got to do with faith development? Just a tremendous amount. If we can't learn as infants to trust, it's going to be very difficult as adults to really trust God and put our total trust in Him and really believe that our sins are forgiven. And all of us that are running around with these loads of guilt, in spite of hearing this gospel message over and over and over, Sunday after Sunday, maybe the reason that we still carry the guilt and can't leave it behind when we walk away from the communion table has got something to do with not having learned to trust as infants. You're really lucky if you've got parents who gratify those basic needs instantly in infancy. This is a worry that I have with daycare with infants. I'm not sure that's just what society ought to be doing, and we're getting more and more institutional group daycare of infants. Because if a mother has a job and she needs the money, she can't take off a long period of time, long enough to develop this. Because this is a period of years, and you're still developing trust in young children, even up to 7 and 8 years of age. So I think this is probably the most important thing for us to think about in our programming at church. Should these people all be banned to a nursery? The first probably 7 months is not as crucial as the 7 to 12 month old, because then they begin to recognize that you are not mother if you're the nursery worker. And I really am not sure that this is a good thing for us to be putting children in the nursery and walking off and letting them scream until they get happy again. You know, they will do that, and they'll get busy with a toy, and they'll forget about mother, because out of sight is out of mind at this age as well. But I think that's really important to think about, that we create some places for mothers of children at that stage to be in the church, even though the children are distracting. How about a pacing place or something? Well, we'll get into that a little bit more later. But these needs have to be met promptly, psychological needs and physical needs. Okay, toddlers, 1.5, 2-year-olds to 3-year-olds, people that are just beginning to toddle about. These children are beginning to acquire language. Now, see, she's talking, but she doesn't have words. But she just said something very important to you. She knows what that we don't, because she hasn't acquired our language that we all use. She's got her own way of communicating there yet. The toddlers still have an extreme inquisitiveness, don't they? You know, and they have no sense to know what's proper to be curious about and what isn't proper to be curious about. So, you know, they would just as lief get into your embroidery bag and investigate that, in spite of the needles and the need for the thread not to get mixed up. But they don't know that that would happen. They're also into labeling things, you know, book, mic, stand, seat, shoes. Oh, shoes, those are biggies with toddlers, aren't they? I don't know why, whether it's because they can see them or what it is about shoes, but, you know, you give a toddler new shoes and everybody will know it. New shoes, new shoes. That's a biggie. And if they're red, that's even more important, because red is the first color that they grasp. The difference at this stage that gives us trouble is that children in the toddler stage begin to realize that they are a separate entity from mother. They're not, that they begin to realize that they have their own feelings and their own will. And there are parent educators that you occasionally will read or hear who say that you've got to, you know, clobber this will right away before it gets too strong or anything. I really take issue with that. I think this will needs to be nurtured, because ultimately I have to relate to God as an individual, not as a group will, not as a part of my mother. And I think one of the problems with mature faith is that it has not become the individuals, it has not attached to the will of that person. It is still my mother's faith, my parents' faith. I came to church, I was brought to church, and I feel guilty if I don't come to church. But I'm not making this individual relationship with my Lord that I need to make. And there are people in church who come routinely that way, and they're not doing this yet, because that ego wasn't nurtured. Now, obviously, when a kid is saying no to everything you ask it to do and me do it to all sorts of stuff that you know it can't possibly do, that creates problems in time, space, and so on. I was watching a baby the other day making the most horrendous mess at the table in the dining hall. But, you know, this is a need of this child to muck about and to do this for myself. So we have to, this is another whole workshop, but this is what psychologists refer to as oppositional behavior, because it opposes the parent's will. Don't get into that power struggle with this age child. You can work around it, because the child, there's so many other things the child doesn't have that you do, that you can work around it rather than hit it head on. That's going to get you big problems in the long run. And some children are worse than others. Our first child was just a classic case of oppositional behavior, and the other kids were much more easygoing with it. I think it reared its head again a little bit more with the fourth one, but by then we saw what the problems that the way we handled it with the first child, which was giving into it, which wasn't helpful either. I mean, you don't allow a 2-year-old to run the house, because a 2-year-old doesn't have enough experience to run the house, nor does it think logically enough to run the house. But sometimes 2-year-olds take over because parents don't know how to handle this oppositional behavior, and their instinct says don't slap it down. And when you slap it down, it just pops back up and makes it worse anyway. Children this age then have this strong need to assert themselves emotionally, the self that they're just discovering. Another problem, another thing that they're doing that creates a problem in church is that they need to practice language. Because they are just beginning to think in words, they need to verbalize these words. And so they talk constantly in church. And, you know, they babble on, and they don't understand why they're told to be quiet in church. I think you can practice at home and sort of train them that in church we whisper, because, you know, this is appropriate behavior, and then we talk out loud when we get out into the narthex again. But then that means that you can only whisper in church, and that the problem is that they don't understand why the pastor can talk out loud, but I have to whisper, you know. But I think children can learn through role play, maybe with the dolls and the teddy bears and things at home, that this is the way we behave in church, and even though the pastor talks, and anybody that gets up to read or something. That the child may want to go up there so he can talk out loud. But this is a necessity for toddlers, because they are learning to think in words. They need to verbalize these words, so they talk constantly. The reason you can't get them to understand that they shouldn't do this is because at this stage, still, not as much as at the baby stage, but, well, I shouldn't say that. Probably they're still about 100% egocentric. It is totally impossible at the toddler stage of life to take another person's point of view. This is why if your kid bites another kid, you don't bite your kid to show him how it feels. All he knows is that, all that says is, big people, you know, if you're big enough, you can bite. You can use this way to manipulate other people's behavior. Look, my mother just did it to me. So going into the early childhood period, from 3 to about 7 or 8, this egocentrism begins to fade, but not a lot. 3-year-olds maybe can share with other kids half the time for a very short space of time, but they really can't understand how the other person, they really think that everybody feels the way they do and everybody knows everybody. Haven't you ever had a 4-year-old come up and start talking to you and say, well, you know, Doris and Marshall came to our house and blah, 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 as though you know who Doris and Marshall are. You know, they assume you do. They're very, very egocentric. Everybody knows everybody. Their world is very small and tiny. Now, you know, this is the way God made them. It isn't something we have to teach out of them or beat out of them. They will outgrow it, but it means that the brain has to grow more years. And then it means that children have to have socially accepting experiences, because what actually happens when you try to force children not to be selfish and egocentric in these early years is that it makes them more selfish and egocentric, because they feel like they have to guard because you're taking away, and because they can't understand the other person's point of view. They can sit a little longer, and the neat thing about preschoolers is they now can begin to entertain themselves, because they can begin to imagine things. If they're given just some tiny little tools, and you will notice children playing with the pencils and the communion cards in the hymnal. I watched the children's choir one time in our church, and because someone had said to me, we shouldn't encourage children to play in church, and I thought, well, I don't want to discourage children from playing, because that's the way children at this stage learn. They learn through play, and play is the way they take in their whole environment. They must manipulate real stuff. They cannot learn through words at this stage yet. It's impossible. They have to have hands-on experience with real stuff to learn, and that means experiences and things. Their motivation, their behavior is very, very strongly motivated by pleasing the parent at this stage. This is where they are in their moral development. They're beginning to need to please important people in their lives, and that's our trump card, because they want so desperately to please and to belong that we can model the kind of behavior we want, and we can reward the behavior that we want and ignore the behavior we don't want, and that reinforces the behavior we do want. But we have to remember that it's, at this stage, children are still totally dependent on us emotionally and physically. Their need to verbalize is less, and so that you can help children at this age to realize that they need to only whisper in church and to talk as little as possible until they get out, except when they're participating with a group. At this stage, they still function intuitively rather than logically. They can't think logically or can't reason logically yet. They're still dependent on what they can perceive. For instance, if I was going to go over and get some clay, but I didn't do it. If I had two balls of clay here, and they were exactly the same, and I squeezed one out into a worm, and we had a four-year-old here, and I'd say, now, which ball has the most clay? Even though they had seen that they were the same originally, they would tell me that the long one was bigger. And I could squeeze it back into the ball and say, now what, you know, are they the same now, or is one bigger? And they'd say, oh, they're the same. And then I could squeeze it back again, and now this one's bigger. Even though they watch you do it, they're dependent on, they can't keep in mind the transformation from one way of being to another way of being. You try that with some four-year-old. Another thing is to take two glasses of water, a long skinny one and a fat one, and you know, pour the water from one to another and ask which has the most, and they'll tell you the tall one has the most, over and over. Because, you know, at a later stage you can say, well, it's the same, you haven't changed the water. But they can only judge it by what they see, not by the logic of it. So that's an important thing to remember about preschoolers too. Primary children, children now that are into school, can begin to reason. For instance, that the clay balls were the same to begin with, so they have to be the same even if I've changed them. Another thing they can do that is different in their thinking is that they can now begin to range backward and forward in space mentally. If you ask a three-year-old where he left his bedroom slippers, he will have to retrace his steps to find them, whereas a six-year-old or a seven- or eight-year-old can say, oh, let's see, wait a minute, I was eating breakfast, did I take them off there? Or then I watched TV, did I take them off there? Or did I leave them in the bathroom? You know, but a three-year-old can't do that. He has to go and hunt for them, actually, physically. Primary children, however, still cannot deal with hypothetical thought, theories, and propositions. They can only do this thinking with real stuff, not with things that you're just proposing to them. They can see all sorts of relationships and things that are real and actualities, but they still don't have the ability to think of all the possible kinds of relationships there are, whether they're actual or hypothetical. And I think this is where we need to keep this in mind as we plan for children's sermons and this kind of thing in church, because this is where it breaks down. Usually you know, whoever's giving the children's sermon goes along real well with some cute little artifact or, you know, the mustard seed or the glass of water or something, but then all of a sudden they switch to an abstract level of thinking and saying, but now this is like the kingdom of God, or, you know, this is the way our sins are washed away or something. The kids can't follow that. They honestly can't. If that person who's giving the children's sermon would now turn to the adults and make that statement, it would make sense, because we can follow it. And you notice most of us really love the children's sermon because we get so much out of it. But the kids are left behind, and the person who is giving this children's sermon really needs to realize it's enough to say, and God gave us this water, and we need water. Isn't that wonderful? You know, then he might deal with, you know, washing us clean in the waters of baptism in the adult sermon, or, you know, turn to the adults and in a couple sentences make this connection for the adult thinkers. But it's lost on the kids. I had the most wonderful children's sermon the other day. Somebody came from Ecuador, and he showed how the blanket was worn by the natives and how the women wore it this way, and this is what the women did with it, and the men wore it this way, and this is what they did with it. And, you know, it was used for carrying things and as a raincoat and so on. And the kids were fascinated with this description of what of the blanket. And all of a sudden he said, and this is the way the Holy Spirit envelops us. And the kids are all sitting there staring at him, and I thought, and, you know, afterwards so many people were saying, that was wonderful. I never thought about the Holy Spirit about that before. What a great picture. But see, the kids didn't get it. But it was wonderful to move from that to that analogy for the adults. But just don't expect the kids to follow. Yeah. I think the thing that sells the children's sermons for me, you know, I don't think they're necessary. Yes, you'd like that too, wouldn't you? I think the thing that happens that is good about them is that the children feel important. And it's the only time in most services that they are included. And I think there's so many other ways that children can be included. Look what happened. You were all here last night. Look at how those children were included. Have you ever heard an adult do a better job than that 7-year-old? I haven't. I've heard adults do worse jobs. She read beautifully. She sang on pitch. You know, the mic went off for a while, but that wasn't her fault. That would happen in a big sanctuary to an adult and you wouldn't hear them. There's no reason why we can't involve the total parish in things like that instead of just the kids. What I've noticed as I've watched children's sermons, we don't have them at the church I belong to, but I do a lot of forums, in Sunday school adult forums, this workshop particularly, in churches, so I get to other churches. And what I notice happens is that the children feel important. It's a warm, cozy time to come up and sit on the floor with the pastor. And it depends on how he does that. I remember one children's sermon that I just wanted to stand up and I really wanted to stand up and yell at the pastor. I was so angry. First of all, he picked a theme from I think it was Ephesians, and I can't think of anything in Ephesians that isn't so abstract the children can't get it. And what he was saying wasn't even true. It was an outright lie, and that's what made me so angry. He stood at the top of the steps. He's over 6 feet tall, and he had a long robe with a stole that made him look even higher. And the kids had to sit down below, and he stood up above, which was the opposite. He should have sat down below and put them on the steps so that he had eye contact with them. So he stood towering over them and told them that they didn't have faith now, but someday they would. You see, and that's not scripturally sound, but he took this one little passage and he worked with that you know, that our faith is a growing thing. Well, that doesn't mean we don't have it when we're little. So, okay, it's really important for us to remember that children think concretely. They only think with real stuff. They can't abstract and make these hypothetical kinds of things. That's really important. And if you have that going on in your church, you know, do something in an adult forum and make sure that the staff is in on that. Get some literature on Piaget and help them. I have read stuff that's come out of church publishing houses where there's a wonderful foreword telling you how children don't think abstractly, and then it goes right on and gives all sorts of abstract activities for the children to do. So I'm not sure everybody understands what abstract thinking means, and we don't have time to get into it any more deeper here. Spirituality comes with a package. This baby is already a spiritual being. God creates us this way. We're made in His image. You know, the amniotic fluid that we lived in the first 9 months of our life is akin to the waters of baptism that surrounds us with this exactly what we need at all times. But I think we can program this away, and that our spiritual nature that we are born with can die of apathy if it isn't nurtured. And I think we need to think about what the weekly worship hour contributes to this. Baptism is a sacrament of belonging. And how do we help children to feel that they are baptized into community? You know, they go through this thing, but do they feel like they're part of this community? And I think this is what we really need to question in the way we run the service. You know, hopefully it would be like now, that this child can have her needs met. She can't be a part of us in the same way that we can be a part of the group as adults, or even the children who can sit still for a while can, because she needs to move all the time she's awake. So, you know, do we provide a place for that to happen, or does she have to be banished from our group? That's the question. Now, you know, obviously if she's so disruptive and screaming and she's having a bad day or something, then that maybe takes away from what the rest of us can do, and there has to be some balance here. Another question I'd like you to think about is, who's responsible for children having their needs met in the worship hour? You know, is it just the mother who gets this burden? You know, is the mother always the one that takes out? Sometimes the father. Or are we all responsible? Is it just the sponsors in baptism of the child who make a commitment to that end in the baptism ceremony? Is it just the church staff? You know, is it up to just the pastor and the CE director or whatever you have, or volunteer teachers? Or is it all of us? You know, I don't have any kids anymore. And I just as lief go to the service where fewer kids go than the one that's the family service, because I'm not raising my kids anymore. But also I enjoy seeing the kids. And if I go to the service and there are no kids there, I feel gypped because I don't have any kids to look at anymore. How does understanding these developmental levels that we just discussed help us to give off the information, both intellectual and information and affective, you know, the feeling level information to the children? And the affective is far more important, especially at this age. I mean, this kid doesn't understand the words at all. So, you know, the feelings from the body language and the tone of voice. I can give you an example of my cat. If I'd go up to my cat when he was on the sofa, where he certainly was not allowed to be, and say, "Now, Buffy, honey, you know you're not allowed on the sofa. Well, so get off the sofa, sweetheart. You need when your hair's on there, and we get them on our clothes." Well, he would just go, "Pah, pah, pah." You know? But if I'd say to him, "Buffy, you're the sweetest little cat that was ever born in this whole world. We just love you." He'd run. See, you know, the words and the tone of voice are giving off. You know, I can say to you, "Gee, that's a nice jacket you've got on. Do you believe me?" No, I have to say, "Wow, I really like that blue jacket. It looks nice with your blue in the shirt. It goes nicely with your hair color. What was the difference?" You know, same words. Tone of voice, body language. You know, you can never say a word to a kid and they get the message that they're not wanted in church. It's you know, we've got to be intentional about the way we, you know, do we pass the peace up here or do we also pass the peace down here where they are? I notice a lot of kids don't even expect the peace to be passed to them. You know, they don't even get out of the pew and look up. What's wrong here? We all need to be including them. So I think we have a challenge as members of the congregation and even a duty to constantly be reminding ourselves and the total faith community to welcome all the members. I mean, we talked about inclusive language a lot over the last few days that I've been here. And I went to one of those sessions and put up my hand and said, you know, I think half the membership is being excluded by all of the language because we don't intentionally use sentence structure and vocabulary for parts of the service that kids can be involved in. I mean, I'll feel chipped if I don't get an adult sermon, but I think there are many ways that children can be involved, and maybe not even with the language, but there needs to be some way that they feel they belong too. The toddlers need to talk. The babies need to walk around. The preschoolers need to wiggle. The school child's need for concrete information, natural and normal and God-given, and just as valid as our needs, is it or isn't it? Because if it isn't, then the kids should be in Sunday school while we're in church or in the nursery or some alternate program. Is it so difficult for us to concentrate on the liturgy and the scripture reading of the sermon over the clattering of falling LBWs and the babble of toddlers and the crying of babies? Yeah, I mean, has this been too disruptive that you haven't been able to concentrate on what I'm doing? You know, you've made the effort, haven't you? And why? Is it partly because I've tried to make it very clear that that child is welcome and part of the group? You know, is that something we need to be intentional about in the service? And it, you know, it starts with the pastor. I don't know if any of you are pastors, but I think that the pastor makes a very clear message and it works down. I was in a church recently where a whole huge group of people are really angry because, you know, the pastor just does not want any of this in the service, and he will not have a children's sermon, and he will not allow any of this including of kids unless it's very special. The children's choir can do it. On Boy Scout Sunday, then they can do it. But there's very little including of children because he wants it to be nice and proper and the way it should be. So it's got to start there. But we, you know, I think we can pressure the clergy to have a different point of view too. And I guess the final question is, can we take the child's point of view and remember it, you know, try to get back to the feelings of what it was like to be a child? Can we empathize and change our expectations for children's behavior in church to suit who they are? I think they'd behave better if we did, but we have to have some way of involving them. So that's what I want to talk about now quickly before, and I talk too long, we're not going to have, I wanted you to have more input here. I think I'll skip a little bit here then because the time's going. I'd like to give you some real solid suggestions to take home of ways that children can be included beside the children's sermon so you can skip the children's sermon. I think a lot of pastors feel really uncomfortable giving a children's sermon because they really aren't trained to write a sermon that doesn't include abstract thinking. It's really hard to do that if you're not trained into it. One thing that helps children behave better, and I remember this as a child, is sitting with other people. You know, especially if you have mother in the choir and father in the choir, or father ushering and mother in the choir, or one of them, you know, parents up in the front, like I had both parents up in the front. Find surrogate grandparents or surrogate family for children to sit with. We had a house church for 7 years that we belonged to, and one of the things we did was to declare a weekend as an alternate family weekend. And the children all phoned whoever's family they thought they would like to belong to. And our kids all went to somebody else's house for the weekend. They went Friday night or Saturday morning, whichever was convenient, and then we met again at church Sunday morning. So they had at least a day, if not a day and two nights, with this other family. And we had other kids come to our house. So, you know, we traded families, traded kids for that weekend. It was really interesting and helped us get to know each other better. But this helps children see the congregation as family. It helps the congregation to become family. Tell new members how the congregation feels about young children. Well, you know, hopefully they have a good feeling about children. But, you know, new members may come with these old expectations that children in this church are frowned upon and shouldn't come and so on. Include short articles in newsletters and bulletins about involving children in worship, and then share that information in dialogue as part of the announcements so that people realize. I mean, think of somebody who's a single parent. How nice that would be for that single parent to have somebody of the opposite sex come and sit alongside their child, maybe on the other side of the child during the service. I think it's important to tell about the characteristics of children, to put this into the newsletter, because we either forget or we've never had input on this at all. Use hymns and poetry to share information and to inspire. I will teach tomorrow what I learned today. Gertrude was telling me last night the most interesting thing about a man who always sang a certain song that had come down in his family when he walked with his baby, you know, at night. And then when the child outgrew babyhood, he never sang the song to her again. And all of a sudden, when she was in seventh grade, he heard her singing the song. And he said, "Where did you learn that?" And she said, "Well, I've always known that." See, and he had sung it to her as a baby. Helping adults learn from children. I mean, we feel like the children are there for us to teach, but we can learn a lot from children. That's why I say I'm disappointed if there aren't any children in my church service. We can learn joy. Look at you all didn't get the privilege of seeing this little child come over and greet you, but what was the feeling on her face? Wasn't it a joyful feeling? I mean, she just was ecstatic, wasn't she? But she suddenly noticed you there and wanted to greet you. My goodness, do we greet each other that way in the service? To be greeted by a baby like that is a real, real treasure. Didn't that give you a lift? You turned on. Your smile came and you felt better. Affirmation. That was an affirmation, wasn't it? Ecstasy. Honesty. Boy, are they ever honest when they're little? They don't know enough to hold in their anger or something. Hope. Feeling of hope from watching little children. Tenderness. Tears. Questions. We sometimes squish that. Love. Laughter. Awareness. Spontaneity. Reconciliation, touch, complete involvement, eagerness to communicate. Wasn't she eager to communicate with you, even though she didn't have words? Clarity of communication. Did you have any trouble knowing what she meant to say? Not a bit. Uninhibited response, motion and rhythm. We can include more of that in our Lutheran services, I think. Imagination, generosity. You know, she might offer you some of her graham crackers. She might also cry if you ate them. Trust. Boy, there's where to get the lesson in trust. Look at a baby or a toddler. Enthusiasm. All of these are things that we can learn from watching the children in the service. Recruit child advocates in the congregation who can hold up and promote involvement of children in worship. There's some people who are terribly creative and have all kinds of good ideas once they're freed to do this thinking. You know, go home and start a committee, somebody that will advocate on the worship committee, or a birth to six committee that will advocate for children's needs to be met in the congregation. Link this to evangelism. You know, if you start, you will find that if you start including children, you will get a lot of people coming to your church who have kids, because people are looking for a place. Kids are involved now in the world. They're not expected to do nothing like kids were in my day. Involve the parish school or the preschool with their worship and education. Tie it into the worship. If you have a preschool in your congregation, ask those children to come and sing or to say something in the service, like this little child did last night. Occasionally, then you see their parents will come. Parents who are unchurched begin to come because their child is involved, and that's the way that these people can be reached with the gospel. You can't reach them if they're at home. Use all congregational arms to invite children to worship in Sunday school, every way you can. Consider adding a preschool if you don't have one, or a day school, or a daycare center, or youth groups, or a choir program. Do you all know about the Alleluia series that Augsburg has? A wonderful weekday series. It's all written out for you, so you don't have to be totally creative with it. Train people who are involved in ministry of welcome, the greeters or the ushers or something, to become child-friendly, so that they stoop down and talk to a child instead of just patting them on the head. Kids don't like to be patted on the head. That doesn't feel good. Recognize children and name them. You know, try to remember the names of the child so that when they come in the next Sunday, you can say, "Well, hi, Stacy. It's good to see you back again." Include children as ushers. Kids can usher. They can take up the offering. I mean, you don't have to be very old to understand how to pass that offering basket, although the first time I did it wrong. But train ushers so that they understand how they should relate to children and include them as much as they do the adults. Another thing I think churches can do is to help families prepare for worship. You might have a forum that where you brainstorm about this, like getting up on time, not staying up so late Saturday morning. Herb's childhood is really, of course, his dad was a preacher and so was mine.